shivat yamim.
She, a woman, after giving birth, is a tmeya. But tmeya, what does tmeya tell me? That she can't eat holy foods and she can't go into holy places. Here there is another aspect. Kimei nidat devotat itma. She is tmeya like a nida. So what does that tell me? What added aspect is this telling me? That she cannot have relations with her husband for a week after birth. Okay? Now.
That's in the case of a male.
In the case of a male. Wait, wait. We didn't come to it. Wait, wait. So the point is like this. What are we talking about? Let's say she has a child, that she has a child and blood came out. Then it's not because she gave birth that she's anida. She's anida because blood came out of her. Says the Talmud, we are talking in a theoretical case where there was a dry birth. I don't know if in medical, there must be medical history such a case. A woman who had a child without losing a drop of blood. There was such a thing.
Yeah, okay.
What? No. Immaculate conception is without a male. But here is a birth without blood. A birth without a loss of blood. I mean, the fact is that some women lose more blood than others. But can you imagine having a child with no blood whatsoever? And now the child comes out and the woman does not lose any blood. This is what we're talking about. Where there is no loss of blood. And therefore we might have thought that therefore she is not anida. She is not in a restrictive state. It tells us that the mere act of having the child is also a cause of the tumah. And that's an important fact, as we are going to see right away. Okay? Yeah.
Isn't it not the mere act, the fact that you don't know, because that thing would open up, blood could have come out and you didn't see it?
Yeah, but we are there. We are there. We have all the sheets that were used, or whatever. And it's all clean. Everything is clean. So we can rely on our own testimony. We see it. There's nothing there. Right? The midwife said, I didn't see any blood. So that's all we can rely upon. Okay? Next. Uvayom hashmini. So for 7 days, she's in a state of impurity. And on the eighth day, she's fine. Right? And on the eighth day, we circumcise the child. So there is a midrash which says, well, it's not a coincidence. The reason why the Torah stops the state of impurity by the seventh day, because in the state of impurity, she can't even touch her husband. So now, at least on the eighth day, we want her to be in a happier mood, right? And since we are going to circumcise the child, it's fitting that the woman should be in a better mood. Therefore, the Torah stops the amount of days of impurity. Okay? And now, here is the follow-up. But if it's a female child, and by a female child, what? There is no circumcision. So by them, it does not stop by the eighth day, the state of impurity. It goes on for 2 weeks, 14 days of impurity. Again, whether she had blood or she had no blood, it's irrelevant. For 2 weeks after the birth of a female child, the woman can't have any sexual relations. She can't go into the Beis HaMikdash, into the temple. She can't eat any truma if she's a priestess or whatever it is. Okay? However, we find another interpretation. Why it's exactly double. Right? It could be more, could be okay. A male is seven, if the woman has a male, the tumah is 7 days, and on the eighth day she's not tameh. But by a female, let's say, should be 8 days, or 9 days, or 10 days. Why exactly 14 double? What's the idea behind it? Okay? So one of the commentaries says the following idea. Let's try to understand. Do you know that every single time, without exception, whenever we find the concept of tuma'ah in the Torah, think of examples, where does the Torah tell us if we are in contact with this and this, we are tamei? It's always associated with something dead. Always. always. You are in touch with a dead rat. You are in touch with a carcass of an animal. You are in touch of a dead person, right? You are in the same building with a dead person, right? Right? Now, what about the fact that a woman, when she has her period, is in a state of tuma? What does that have to do with death? Is there any association here? A woman, when she has her period, she becomes tmeya because there is a connection with death. What?
The weeping of a frustrated uterus.
Oh, in other words, a uterus that wasn't used out. Exactly. That is the idea mentioned in our commentaries. That the idea of the tuma'ah, of the impurity of the during a period, is simply because when a woman's ovum, right, hasn't been fertilized, it's lost, right? It's lost. And then all the blood that became prepared for the conception, right, comes out of the body. That's all. It's like the body, like you say, it's like cries for the lost opportunity, so to speak. It's interesting. That's what we find in our commentaries. Yeah, that's really the... That's a very, very interesting thing. Very, very interesting thing. You know, it's the lost life opportunity. The body is showing the loss of life, the loss of the life opportunity, right? Not that there is anything wrong. We are not describing a transgression. We are just describing a fact that the potential of life is so great that the lack of it, right, creates tuma. Like when a person dies, you know why there is tuma? Because the void left, right, that void of life gets in it like an anti-life force. Again, it's the loss of life. Loss of life causes tuma. So that is the concept of tuma. Tuma is always associated with death because it represents the loss of life. Either the loss of actual life, like a person dying, or loss of potential life, which is a woman having her menstruation. Right? But if so, it doesn't make any sense. Here is the first apparent paradox. A woman who has a child, that's the fulfillment of life. How come there is here something associated with death? Tuma has to do with death. Right? Yeah?
In a way, she lost that life.
Okay, good, good. They say, fine. We are not talking that universally there was a loss of life. But she is experiencing a personal loss of that experience. Now life is outside of her. Up to now, life was within her. Okay? So, if so, this is the way the commentary see having a boy. When you are having a boy, that life, represented by the number 7, because 7 always represents, it's never coincidental, the number 7 always represents a natural cycle. A natural cycle, right? When a person mourns for a close relative, 7 days, because death is part of a natural cycle. Therefore, the loss of that child from within her to outside of her is for her an experience of loss, even though in real life it's an experience of gain. She has a child, but the insides of her are still like it losing something. So that loss is represented by the 7 days at the commentaries. When a woman has a male child, she is having a life. But when a woman has a female child, she not only is giving birth to a life, but she's giving birth to a life who begets life. Do you hear the difference? So in a way, it's life times two, in a way. That's right. In order to represent that, what does the Torah say? The days which represent that loss should be multiplied by two. This is why it's not a coincidence that if a woman has a male child, it's 7 days, and if it's a female child, it's 14 days. Because since the whole point is the loss of that inner experience of life, when she loses the female child, right, she is losing even more, right? It's just, it's an experience of loss. It's not that she's really losing, just the opposite, she's gaining. But the fact is, the inside of her is not carrying a child anymore. Right?
No life inside. What about if she has twins, one boy, one girl?
Okay, so when she has twins, the days of the girl, right?
It's 14,
and that overcomes the days of the boy.
Oh, so it's not 21 days.
No, it's not 21 days, it's 14. They overlap. 14 days of separating, even though you circumcise the child on the eighth day, she's still in a state of impurity for 14 days. Okay?
And twin girls would still be 14.
Still be 14 because they overlap. Okay? Next. So, before we go on to the next part, the female child, let me just read to you the Rashi, the first Rashi. What bothers Rashi, and really Rashi is just quoting the rabbis, that if you look, remember, the Torah is, when you, that we divide it into parshiot every week, right? But in a way, this is artificial, the division. I mean, really, you have to look at all the portions of the Torah as a continuum. If so, if you look at it as a continuum, you'll see something very, very strange. You know that the book of Vayikra mostly is a description of sacrifices, tabernacle, the inauguration of the tabernacle, mostly, and then laws of Tumah v'Tahara, you know, who needs to come to the priest, and that is the afterwards the law of the leper, and so on and so forth. But right there in the middle, right in the middle of the book of Vayikra, you have a description of kosher foods, which have really very little to do directly with sacrifices. Because it's not which sacrifices are kosher, which foods are kosher. What kind of birds are you allowed to eat? What kind of animals are you allowed to eat? What kind of grasshoppers are you allowed to eat? You know, there are certain ones that you're allowed to eat. Yemenite Jews still eat it up to this day, right? So, and that is described, you know where, in last week's portion of the week, right? Where is that? It starts in chapter 11, right last chapter. Take a look. I just want to show you like the highlights of that portion. Chapter 11, right in the beginning. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe vel Aaron lemor aleihem. Daber bnei Yisrael, speak to the Jewish people. Lemor. Zot hachaya asher tochlu. This is the animal you are allowed to eat, etc., etc. If it has split hoofs and they choose its cud, okay, that is the animal. And then it goes on in verse number 5. And these are the ones that you're allowed to eat, the rabbit, and you know, all those that you're not allowed to eat, and so on and so forth. And then it goes on with the fish in verse number 9, everything about the fish. And then in verse number 13, all the birds you're not allowed to eat, right? That's everything about which animals are kosher, which animals are not kosher. And right after that, and if a woman has a child, this and this and this is what happened. If you're going to be talking about animals, birds, fish, right, and human beings, what would be the order you would write it in? I mean, I think they deserve at least this attention.
Unless
that you should...
Creation.
What? Oh, good, all right. But you see what bothers the rabbis. It bothers the rabbis, after all, we are more important. So, says Rashi the following, I'll read the Rashi, because... Amar Rab Simlai, this is the rabbi that he's quoting. Kishem sheyitzirato shel adam achar kol behema You know why this is mentioned after everything else? Because human being was created after everything else. Kol ve'imach haya ve'of b'masei breishit kach torato nitparsha achar torat ve'imach haya ve'of. Now, the truth of the matter is, I'm not trying to put down his answer, right? And your answer. But it's really quite simple, right? The truth is that it's... You know, Rashi shouldn't have just quoted the rabbis. Rashi quotes the rabbis when you have like an overwhelming question. And he says, you know what the answer is? The rabbis say such and such and such. Something which is some pure, pure logic. Rashi would just say, and this and this and this is the fact. Rashi won't quote the rabbis. This, would you say, goes into the category of the extraordinary answer or the ordinary answer of Rashi? I would say it's an ordinary answer. I'm not trying to put it down, but it's, you know, it's simple, of course. I mean, we do find that the human being was created after the animals, so why shouldn't he be mentioned after the animals? Right? But the interesting thing is, the commentaries say the following. Do you know the Talmud actually asks, why was man created after the animals? Why didn't he deserve, right? Like the attention of being created first. God says that man is the crown of the world, the goal of the creation, and what do? You bring him in last. If he's so important, bringing him into the world first, right?
Which yeah.
What? The, oh, right, yeah. Yeah. Oh, so, yeah. Arrogance. Yeah?
Hashem created everything for us.
Ah, exactly. So he says like this. This is the way the Talmud puts it. Talmud puts it in the following way. It says, the truth of the matter is that everything in the world was created for men. And therefore we might use the following analogy. If you are going to be inviting to your house a most important guest, and you prepare a great banquet for him, what would you do first? Would you bring in the tables and the chairs and the tablecloths and the egg and the breads and the salt and the drinks and then the guest? Or you would say, no, the guest is so important, let him come first. So first he comes and he stands, then I bring him a chair, then a table, then a piece of bread. What would you do first? Obviously, it's part of the honor that he deserves that you should prepare everything before, so by the time he comes, everything is ready for him. This is the reason why he was created last. Now, this is only if a person does what he's supposed to do in this world, then he's a welcome guest. But what about if he acts in a way that he's not a welcome guest in the world? Ah, at that point, you know what the order will remind him? That he's really last. That he's really the last one in order of importance. Here, in other words, if you act like a good visitor in the world, like you're supposed to be, then your coming last is a sign of honoring you. But if you don't act as a important guest, so what are you? Another being. So how come you came in last? This is what God tells you. That's what you are, last. You are even worse than the mosquito, says the Talmud. Right? You came into the world even after the mosquito. So look how important you are. Look what God thinks of you. And that's exactly the truth. A person who does not fulfill his obligations in this world, right? He's worse than the mosquito. The mosquito at least didn't use out his free will for something bad, and you did. Okay? So now, according to this, comes out that it's not that it's the fact that God created men last is something which is an absolute expression of respect for man. The meaning of why we were created last depends on our own actions. Here. Right? Now, what are we talking about here? God says to men how to act in a way to remain in a state of purity. Not to eat non-kosher food, to eat only foods which are good for him. And not only that, You must always, this is how the whole portion, the last week's portion of the week concludes. In the last verse of last week's portion of the week, it's one of the crucial verses of the whole Torah. Lehavdil bein hatamei uvein hatahor. The job of men in the world, if you can find like a concise way of expressing it, what is our obligation in this world? To make distinctions. Lehavdil, to make distinctions. Only a human being has the capacity to make subtle distinctions. If we would be able to make subtle distinctions, we would be fulfilling the obligation of men in this world. Okay? What happens if you do make subtle distinctions? Then you are a welcome guest. Right? And then, the reason why man is mentioned after animals becomes a sign of respect for men. What Rashi is hinting is the opposite. What about if the opposite is true? What about if you eat everything? That means what do you lack? Distinction, the capacity of making distinctions. Then what is the reason why you are mentioned last? Because that's what you deserve, because you are worse than the animals. Okay? You know, that itself is what you do is what puts you in that status. That's the idea behind it. Okay? So the point is that being mentioned last is like a threat, a warning. Right? You are either the best, a human being is either the best of the world or the worst in the world. Either he is an honored guest or he is less than a mosquito. That's the idea behind it. This is what Rashi is hinting to. And what is the best sign of it? What foods you eat. Because if you give in to your physical desires, you are an animal. If you control your physical desires, then you are a human being. Okay? Yeah. Yeah,
because
yeah.
The nature of the mosquito is such that it has a stinger that it plunges into the person and it takes. It can only take, it can't give out anything.
Interesting.
And if you are behind the mosquito, it means you're even worse than a creature.
You know, you are just. You can, yeah.
You're worse than a creature that only
very
can
nice.
Take.
Very nice.
So it gives a reason for
the mosquito. Right. Because the Talmud actually mentions a mosquito, Yitosh.
It's natural. No, that's what transmits malaria.
It's even worse. You know, it gives over sicknesses. Now it doesn't do. He's a carrier of disease.
So,
but that's even better yet. You know, and when he gives, it's only to destroy. It's only poison, right? That's it's good. It's good. Makes sense. All right, let's go on to the next verse. Now, take a look in verse number 3. Now, so how many days did we say is she in the state of impurity even if she didn't see any blood? Let's say for a male child.
Seven
days, right? And a female child, 14 days. Now, listen to what happens now. So we might have thought, just from the verses we read up to now, what happens on the eighth day? Fine. She can live with her husband. Can she go into the temple? You're right, no. But we might have thought. Yes, that's what we might have thought. Comes the Torah and tells you she is pure, but not completely. There is like an in-between state. Listen to this very strange in-between state. Now, Ushloshim yom ushloshet yomim. For 33 days, she's in a strange state. I don't know how to describe it exactly. The state of the woman during the 33 days. What is her state? Teishev, she must stay in a state of demei tahara. An unusual thing. Listen to this, like, very odd law. What about if on the 8th day, 9th day, 10th day, she has her period? Let's say it's unusual. Right after birth, a woman doesn't have her period for a long time, but let's say she does. So, what might you think? Well, so now, she is restricted like a regular nida, like a regular woman having her period. No, says the Torah. She's exempted from impure blood for 33 days, which means during those 33 days, even if she sees blood, we don't consider it her period. It's exempted blood for 33 days, here. During the first 7 days, even if she does not see blood, she's in a state of impurity. During the 33 days, even if she does see blood, she's in a state of super purity. She's so super pure that it even overcomes the impurity of her own period, of her own blood. Strange, right? Well, but now that the Torah says it, we say, okay. So she's in a state of super purity, right? That's what it sounds like? Super purity, even more than usual? Well, not really. Because it says the following. Vel hamikdash, I'm sorry. Bechol kodesh lo tiga. But let her not touch any thing which is holy. Like I told you, truma, that holy food. What about coming into the temple? Oh no. Vel hamikdash lo tavo. She can come in. But if she's super pure, why can't she come in? Because she's in a half state. A mixture of super purity and super impurity. What does it mean, super impurity? That she can't even do anything during those 33 days to get her out of that state of impurity. Do you hear that strange combination of those 33?
She can't touch anything holy.
Anything holy. Just an example. Holy for instance, I'm just giving an example. Let's say she is the wife of a Kohen. A Kohen, a priest. A priest is allowed to eat truma. Food that was put apart, set apart for him, right? And that food has a status of holiness. And the Kohen is allowed to eat it, and his family is allowed to eat it when they are in a state of purity. Okay? This is an example. A woman during the 33 days cannot eat the truma. But why? But she can live with her husband, right? And the blood that she sees is not even considered impure blood. Do you hear the paradox of it? Right? And how many days again?
33.
Remember, you know that numbers are never, ever. No, what do you mean? Outside the seven. Outside the seven. When you add it up, what do you have? 40. 40, okay? 33. It's very relevant, the number 33, to the period of that we are going through right now, by the way. We'll see right away. 33. Two? Lag Bomer. Soon, in less than a month from now, there is going to be like a semi-festival, and that semi-festival is called what? Lag Bomer. You know what the word lag comes from? 33. Lamed Gimel. 33. And the 12th of May. That's what it comes out this year. Oh, no wonder. Remember, you're the Mazel Tov. His daughter is getting married. No wonder. 33. But really, it's a very strange day, the 33. It's part of the Omer. It is part of the Omer, the 33, right? But it's not part of the Omer. We can have parties and we can have weddings. And it's a mitzvah to, you know, it's a custom to be specially happy. Why? What is Lag BaOmer? Also the number 33. Very strange. The number 33, Kabbalistically, is a very strange number, 33. So we're going to be talking about it. The meaning of the number 33. It's not a coincidence. The Torah keeps stressing 33. Now, let's go on by the woman. Because by the woman, since everything is doubled, remember, the days of impurity is what? 40. So it makes sense the days of this super purity should be, the same way that the impurity is twice 7, should be twice 33. Which is 66, but it's basically 33 twice. Like, her impurity is 7 twice. So again, the key number again is 33, not 66, okay? So let's go on here. Verse number 5. Ve'im nekeva teleid. What about if the woman will give birth to a female child? Ve'tam'a shevu'aim. She has to be in a state of impurity, shvuaim, 2 weeks, shvuaim, 2 weeks. Kenidata, and what laws does she have? Like anira, in other words, what is she restricted? Not only can she go into the temple, but she can't have marital relations. And v'shishim yom v'sheshet yamim, and for 66 days, teishev, she stays in a state of the meitahara, of pure blood, which means even if she sees blood, the blood doesn't take away her basic purity. Okay? Uvimlot yemei tahara, and when the period is over, how many days again? From the beginning of the birth. 66 plus 14. Right? It's for the female. 66 plus 14 for the female, how much is that? 80. And for the male? 7 plus 33, which is 40. Okay, so here is 40 and 80. Also, Kabbalistically, very important numbers. 80 is just twice 40, right? But the number, the crucial number here is 40, right? So we have three important numbers. 7, 33, and 40. Okay, let's go on. So what does she do in verse number 6? Uvimlot yemei tahara. And when the days of purity end, leven, for a boy, after 40 days, or levat, or for a girl, after 80 days, tavi keves ben shenato le'ola. She has to bring a lamb for a burnt offering, right? Uven yona otor lechatat. And she has to bring a sin offering. Here. A sin offering. Sin. Now, this is very, very difficult. A sin offering? When do people bring a sin offering? Sin. When they commit a sin. What sin has she committed? She had a girl. But when she had a boy, that's for sure a mitzvah. Right? I'm just joking. It's the same mitzvah. Right? Huh? So what's wrong? Why does she have to bring a sin offering? Oh, you see? Exactly. All right. So the rabbis give an answer which is so shocking, which is more difficult than the question. The rabbis say, well, certainly when a woman gives birth, it's a pretty painful experience. It must be that while she was giving birth and going through the pain, the following thought probably crossed her mind, that, right, never again. Right? She, in the ways of the rabbis, she made a neder in some place, say shvua, whatever, it's some kind of a vow, that she will never live with her husband again. Right? Therefore, she has to bring a sin offering.
Would this also go back to the beginning of creation?
Oh, good. So you're coming to the real answer. You're right. But the superficial answer is so obviously difficult that it must mean something else, right? Because number one, what's wrong with having thoughts? So I have thoughts, right? So I'll never do it again. What about, I have to do a mitzvah. Let's say I'm running to give charity and I fall down and I hit my head and I say, oh, I'll never do it again. So what? So that's a terrible sin. So it crossed my mind, but did I do anything about it? Since when are we obligated for thoughts that cross our minds? Especially, we know that there is never a prohibition against evil thoughts. I always clarify it, right? Never. We never find a prohibition of thoughts coming to your mind. The prohibition is only when you allow that thought to linger in your mind. A thought that comes into your mind and you immediately reject it, you are not responsible for that thought. As a matter of fact, I mentioned this to you, that this is why a thought that enters your mind is called machshava, very closely connected with nachash, a serpent. Because a thought is like a serpent. In other words, an outside power entering your mind. Is there anything wrong that Eve spoke to the serpent? Nothing wrong. Speaking to the serpent is thinking. But the obligation of Eve was to reject the argument of the serpent. Our obligation is to reject the thought. Let's say, I have a thought, oh, I wish I can rob a bank. Is the thought in itself wrong? The moment I say, no, I'm not going to do it, I don't want to do it because it's against the Torah. What can be better than that? That the thought crosses my mind and I reject it because it's against the Torah. Sure, nobody denies there is an even higher level where my mind is so controlled that it doesn't even allow the serpent to enter. But that is a level that not everybody can reach. The level of the masses, of the average human being, is that he cannot control thoughts that enter his mind, but he has the power to reject those thoughts. If so, right, what's wrong with a woman whose that thought enters her mind and she immediately rejects it? Right? That's the first question. Second question. It says, Ein Adam Nitpas, a person is not responsible b'shat tzaroi, when something which he does out of pain. When a person is in pain, he is not responsible even for what he says, it says. You know that in one of the places, in one midrash, it says, Job made some kind of a remark about God, how he allows injustice in the world. Says one of the sages, don't blame him because he was saying it out of pain. He had lost all his family, his wealth, his health. Don't blame a person of saying something when he's in pain, right? So, according to this statement, can you blame a woman who has gone through such an experience, such a painful experience, that at that moment that crosses her mind? Doesn't make sense. You hear from all sides, it doesn't make sense. Now, even assuming that, yeah, she is responsible, and she made a vow, what is the method of annulling a vow? Bringing a sin offering? Never ever do we find such a thing when you want to dissolve, when you want to annul a vow. Which is the way to annul a vow? What? There is a method. You know what the method is? You come in front of three rabbis, alright? And you say, I made a vow to do such and such and such, and now I regret it and I want to change my mind. And the rabbis ask, what is your opening? In other words, what are the circumstances that made you change your mind? And the person says the circumstances. And the rabbis judge the situation and then they annul. But there is no thing as a sin offering. Okay. So from all these, one thing we know for sure, that there is something else behind it. Right? We can't take it literally, that a woman is being is considered a sinner because the thought of not having relations with her husband is crossing her mind. Right? Besides, nowadays, we can ask other questions. What about if she didn't even feel the birth? Right? Right? Today, right, a woman can go through childbirth without knowing she's having childbirth. And we have proof that in the days of the Talmud, some sort of method was known even then. Because in the Talmud it speaks about how much would a person pay for having the cut made without pain. So you see, there was a price for doing something with, what is it called? With anesthetics. So there was, so it was known. So they knew that there was a thing as anesthetic. What goes on here is something else. As you mentioned before, we very often, see ourselves as part of the totality of mankind. Sometimes we see ourselves as a person. I am I. But sometimes I am the representative of the whole. Like, for instance, let me give you an example where Jews become the representative of something else which they are not. Do you know that it says that they bring a sin offering? Every Rosh Chodesh, every new moon, you bring a sin offering. Right? And the Talmud asks, why do you bring a sin offering every Rosh Chodesh? For the moon's sin. You realize how strange that is? Did you ever hear this? That you bring a sin offering on the new moon, on Rosh Chodesh, for the sin of the moon. What is the sin of the moon? What is the terrible sin of the moon?
The sun.
Exactly. The jealousy of the sun. And now, as they said to God, why do you have two kings in the same kingdom? So God said, what a good idea. So I'll cut you down to size. And this is why the moon has to shrink, disappear, and come back, disappear, and come back.
Said that
what?
Who said that to God?
The moon. The moon. Of course, how are we to understand this metaphor? How are we to understand? How are we to understand it? Obviously, the moon has no free will because it's not a human being. Anyone without free will can't make mistakes because it's just an instrument in the will of God. So what is it? What does it represent? You know, we spoke about the fact that we pray for the moon. We pray for the day when the moon won't have to suffer anymore, when the moon won't shrink anymore. Do you know that it's such a prayer? Lemalot pgimata levana velo yesh bo shumiyut. V'yeh or halevana ke'or hachamad, when the moon will remain like, will be like the sun, like it was during the days of creation. What do we care what the moon will be like? We have to stick up for the moon. So remember, I once told you this, a very, very important thing, that very, very often we pray by transference. There is such a thing as the transference of prayer, right? We can look at a tree and we see in the tree the future of the Jewish people. So we say to God, please God, don't let the tree dry up. Give it strength and let it grow. And what do we mean? We mean the Jewish people. In other words, we take the example, the analogy, and we sort of pray to the analogy while we mean the real thing. So when we say, let the moon never shrink again, you know what we mean? That we Jews should never have to go into exile again, and we should stay in Israel, and our relationship should be complete. That's what we mean. That's what we mean. The same way, when we pray, when we say, a woman had a thought not to have relations with her husband because she had pain. You know where pain from childbirth starts from? Adam and Eve. Adam and Eve. That's when pain for childbirth came to the world. And every time a woman repeats that experience, right, we associate ourselves with that universal flaw. Because if Eve did it, then it's a universal flaw. And therefore, we don't mean literally that we blame her personally for saying something while she's in pain. Nobody's responsible for what you say in pain. We are talking about the universal meaning of that statement. I can't take it anymore. I don't want to ever do it again. We see the universal meaning of that statement. What is it? The sin of Adam and Eve, which still has not been rectified. This is the meaning of the sin offering that a woman gives right after childbirth. We'll continue later tomorrow. Is anybody interested in davening mincha?